From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, it's our annual year-end review of the best movies and the best rock, pop, country, and hip-hop of the year. First, our film critic David Edelstein joins us with his 10 best list. He'll also recommend movies to see and avoid over the holidays. Then rock critic Ken Tucker will play us some of the recordings on his 10 best list. The best in movies and music coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's time for our annual 10 Best show, in which our film critic David Edelstein and our rock critic Ken Tucker present their lists and review the year. We'll start with David Edelstein. We asked him to also give us a roundup of the movies in theaters for the holidays. Welcome, David. Well, in a few moments, actually, we're going to get to your 10 best list. But first, you're going to talk with us about holiday movies. So I thought we could start with a film that appears on both lists. It's a film opening for the holidays that's actually at the top of your 10 best list. And the film is Munich, directed by Steven Spielberg and written by Tony Kushner, who also wrote the play Angels in America. So what makes this film your favorite of the year?
Well, my passion since becoming a film critic and also my bugaboo has been the vigilante, vengeance, revenge, retaliation genre, call it what you will. I find it incredibly seductive, you know, to see movies in which there's an injury against somebody and then the hero goes out and busts some heads and gets a piece of his own back. Now, I believe that this is a sort of horrible thing for us to cheer on. At the same time, I understand that we're all very vulnerable to it, which brings us to Munich, which is very specifically about retaliation. It's the story of a secret force organized by the Mossad that retaliates for the massacre of 11 athletes at the 72 Olympics. And it constantly wrestles, the script by Tony Kushner constantly wrestles with the issue of what retaliation accomplishes. Is it vital to attack one's foes? Does it create peace in the long run, or does it breed more violence and destroy the people and the countries that practice it? I think it's a remarkable film. It has you sort of whipped up by the assassinations that these people carry out, and at the same time, kind of conscience stricken at the fact that these are human beings with their own vital beliefs.
I know there's some controversy surrounding the film. I believe the members of the Israeli government haven't been very pleased with it. What's the controversy about?
Well, I mean, if I were the Israeli government, I wouldn't be too pleased with it either, insofar as it does not portray the Palestinians as evil. And so this is the kind of a revenge movie with a conscience. People may feel who believe in retaliation, who believe that it is vital for a nation state to strike back when it is injured, may feel that the movie is sort of skewed to the kind of peacenik side. I'm used to a cinema in which revenge is so much a part of, you know, of the vocabulary of movies that I think this kind of movie is a tonic and is a vital corrective. And it's also, you know, Spielberg's often concerned with absent fathers and you know, the lack of the moral reassurance that they can provide. And here the protagonist's father is a distant presence. He's never shown. The surrogate father is an Israeli Mossad agent played by Jeffrey Rush, who is, you know, unreliable in the extreme. So the entire world is presented as without a sane moral center. And I don't know, as far as I'm concerned, it's an extraordinarily realistic and balanced portrait.
Two new musicals have opened for the holidays. Rent opened for Thanksgiving and is still in many theaters. And The Producers is opening for the holidays. Both of these were very successful on Broadway. The Producers was a phenomenon, and Rent was heralded as like reviving the musical for a new generation. So what are the movie versions like?
Well, it's not a great season for musicals. Rent, look, I know Rent has, you know, many, many passionate admirers on Broadway, and I know that, you know, it is a very moving story of how the composer, Jonathan Larson, wrote it shortly before he died, before he could see the great commercial success that it was going to achieve. I think as directed by Chris Columbus, it's sort of like a new ride at Disney World, you know, the urban AIDS victim jamboree, which I found, I don't know, kind of icky, I guess. Every time somebody opens their mouth with one of the show-stopping songs, everybody else joins in. And so on one level, you're inspired by the communal spirit, by the way people pull together in the face of tragedy. On the other hand, there's very little drama. And it even borders on the saccharine, even with all these people dying of AIDS. As for The Producers, that's just excruciating. That's The movie, directed by Susan Stroman, is pitched to the second balcony, and she just transplanted it from Broadway with all that retro Queenie, you know, camp stuff intact. And I found the performance is just, for the most part, really horrible.
Well, you know, The Producers was a movie that got made into a Broadway musical that got transferred back to the world of movies again. So you don't think that this movie measures up to the original movie?
Well, the original was certainly in your face, but you had this extraordinary force of nature, Zero Mostel, and you had this extraordinary performance by Gene Wilder. You know, this was our sort of introduction to his peculiar kind of hysterical, etherized delivery that was, you know, and they were an absolutely beautiful match. Here you have Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, who are both basically on the same plane of reality. Matthew Broderick hasn't scaled down his performance one bit for the stage. He's popping his eyes. He's very much a cartoon. And Nathan Lane just doesn't have the, you know, he's fun to watch on stage, but he doesn't have the subtext, the layers. When you look at his face on screen, there's really not much to see.
Woody Allen has a new film, Matchpoint, that's opening in New York and L.A. for the holidays, and then will open in the rest of the country later. Everyone who I hear mention this film starts it by saying the same thing. They express their surprise that it's a good Woody Allen movie. So do you think it's good, too, and are you surprised?
Well, you know, it's the depressing thing about the last few years, maybe the last 20 years, is kind of watching Woody Allen sort of sink deeper into his own kind of insular misanthropy, and, you know, basically this sense that he was writing and directing a movie a year at least, but nothing was coming in anymore. He was just reshuffling the same old themes. Matchpoint is basically the same old things. It's crimes and misdemeanors transported to England. I mean, I'm talking pretty literally here. But the great thing is that it doesn't look or sound or feel like any other Woody Allen movie, which makes it pretty inspiring. It's very smoothly made. There's a ton of suspense, which is really unusual. It's got, you know, wonderful performances by an actor who's never impressed me, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, and Scarlett Johansson. It's got this air of very ambiguous sexuality to it. In some ways, it's a more successful movie than The Talented Mr. Ripley, sort of working on with many of the same themes. I mean, what the problem is that you get Woody Allen's kind of sophomore existentialism and atheism thrown in. You know, if you commit a crime and God doesn't punish you, then there's no God. Okay, you know, whatever. Okay. Well, you know, whatever. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there's a God or not, but, you know, I'm not going to take Woody Allen's word for it because, you know, the police don't pick up somebody who's committed a crime.
What are some of the other movies that you'd recommend for the holidays?
Well, there's a wonderful movie called Transamerica with Felicity Huffman, a stage actress who also has scored a hit recently on Desperate Housewives. It's about a man on the brink of a final sex change operation who learns he has a son. It's sitcom stuff, but it's not played like a sitcom. And at the same time, it's hugely entertaining. And Felicity Huffman is so great. I mean, she's playing a man becoming a woman. And it's kind of like she deconstructs and reconstructs a woman before your eyes. Her movements and her gestures as a woman are almost convincing, but they're always kind of like a beat off. I hesitate to use the word because it sounds pretentious, but it's a true Brechtian performance, and it's absolutely delightful.
And is there a movie or two that you'd recommend we avoid for the holidays?
Well, apart from the producers, The New World is a great disappointment. I know everybody loves the cult director Terrence Malick. This is the fictionalized story of John Smith and Pocahontas. It's sort of like Brokeback Wigwam. The lovers can't build on their elemental passion. It's also the same theme that Malick used in The Thin Red Line. We begin in Eden. We go to hell, we return to Eden. It's very self-consciously lyrical, very meditative, and, you know, at 2.5 hours, absolutely stultifying.
My guest is David Edelstein, Fresh Air's film critic, and we've been talking about movies that are around in theaters for the holidays. Let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll do your 10 best list. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air's film critic, David Edelstein. Okay, David, it's that special time of the year, time for me to ask you to present your 10 best list.
Terry, this 10 best list, you ain't going to see this anywhere else. You know, first of all, I cheated like mad since I have two double features here. I always have a terrible time because I love movies and I love even crap movies. And this year there were just a million movies that I really adored. But here it is. Number one is, of course, Munich, which I've already talked about. Number two is Junebug, an extraordinarily ambiguous film about the North-South divide. I don't think it gels, but I haven't seen a film that tantalizing in a long time. My number three is Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. That's just one that everybody I know agrees on. It's pure bliss. It's part Ealing comedy, part Hammer horror movie. It's witty. It's loving. It's an absolute must-see, with or without the kids. My fourth favorite movie of the year is Miranda July's debut feature, Me and You and Everyone We Know. Some people regard this as very performance arty and self-indulgent, but I actually think it's an amazing distillation of the culture, of a culture in which young people today, young people, are floating in their own bubbles and struggling to connect in all kinds of weird and perverse ways. Number five is going to be slightly controversial, and that's another Spielberg movie, War of the Worlds. A lot of critics were appalled that Spielberg would use imagery that invokes 9/11 in what they thought of as a popcorn entertainment. But I think it's a really serious movie and very disturbing. And I also believe that even big-budget summer sci-fi movies are supposed to confront national traumas. And I don't find even a whiff of exploitation in what Spielberg does in this film. My first double bill, number six, is what I call my Shakaruni double bill. And that's The Aristocrats and Sarah Silverman, Jesus's Magic. These are two movies that center on how far you can go in the bad taste scatological department. And I don't know what they amount to, but I laughed my head off. The Aristocrats deconstructs a disgusting joke and tells you a lot about our taboos and about the kinds of people who are in business to flout them. The Sarah Silverman movie, Silverman, her persona on stage, it's like a pipeline to the id of the sort of over-entitled, solipsistic, materialistic, prejudiced, insensitive, and oversexed American upper-middle-class female. And I thought it was absolutely revelatory. My number seven movie is The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, which is Tommy Lee Jones' directorial debut. It's a very leisurely, widescreen Western. It's a little sentimental in its construction, but that sentiment is really cut by the ghoulish humor involving the dead man's corpse, which sort of decays progressively in front of your eyes and kind of throws the nobility of the whole thing into question. My eighth favorite movie is Grizzly Man, Werner Herzog's documentary about a man eaten by bears. And that's a case where the subject's personality and the director's personality just dovetail insanely well. Both figures are kind of self-dramatizing, a little scary, and yet the movie is kind of a profound lesson in the limits of loving nature. Number nine is my second double bill, and it's what I think of as underpraised genre films. These are movies that, you know, I think got really short shrift from critics because they just came from disreputable or B genres. Skeleton Key and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Skeleton Key is a horror movie, very unsung. Maybe the last feature we'll see from New Orleans before the flood really captures the place and the surrounding countryside. It turns on a history of racial injustice, on gri-gri, you know, the local voodoo, on revenge. It's an almost bottomless pit of horror. And there are great performances by Jenna Rollins and Kate Hudson. Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang is Shane Black's very jokey film noir with kind of a surprising kick and a great leading man turned by Robert Downey Jr. My last film is one that was very hard to put on my list because I found it absolutely unbearable. And I don't ever want to see it again. It's called Nobody Knows. It's directed by the Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. It's the true story of a single mother who abandoned her children for large stretches and about how they managed to pull together and somehow cope, even though there's a very tragic turn near the end. I don't think I'll shake this movie off for the rest of my life. And, you know, I recommend it very guardedly, but it's haunting and it's profound and it's a great humanistic work of art.
In this end-of-the-year wrap-up, can we put in a good word for George Clooney and his film Good Night and Good Luck and his performance in Syriana?
We certainly can. You know, I find it really exciting that that Clooney is a guy who not only wants to be a big star, a sort of Cary Grant-like star, but he also wants to be a very conscientious force for change in this country. He's throwing his weight behind some very exciting projects. Good Night and Good Luck was somewhat fictionalized, but nevertheless rather pertinent parable about threats to free expression. You know, not one of my favorite movies of the year, but extraordinarily powerful and well-made. Syriana, I found, you know, borderline incoherent, but, you know, I admire the hell out of the attempt to sort of connect all these different threads to account for where we are in the Persian Gulf and kind of the origins of terrorism. And yes, you're right. I mean, I think there was, I know he went through hell, you know, with his weight gain, but I think he gives a kind of a naked performance in that film that we haven't seen from him since the very underrated Steven Soderbergh film Solaris. He really is an extraordinary actor, as well as being, you know, a kind of true American successor to Cary Grant.
David, what were some of your favorite performances of the year?
There were so many. I wish I were one of those, you know, radio guys who gives the little disclaimers at the end of commercials so I could just go Upside of Anger, Joan Allen, Walk the Line, Joaquin Phoenix and Reese Witherspoon, Capote, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Squid and the Whale, Jeff Daniels and Jesse Eisenberg, Dark Water, another underrated genre film, Jennifer Connelly and John C. Reilly, Heath Ledger, Ralph Fiennes as Voldemort. Oh, what a scary performance, even when his features were only half formed in the primordial slime. Diane Keaton, Viggo Mortensen and Maria Bella and William Hurt and Ed Harris in History of Violence, Amy Adams and Junebug, A Kid in Mysterious Skin, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Donald Sutherland, Keira Knightley, everyone in Pride and Prejudice, Mickey Rourke in Sin City, and Bill Murray.
Let me express my pleasure that you're not that kind of guy.
But I want to get everyone in because I love them all and I wish they all could get awards. They all get Davids, if not Oscars.
What messages do you think that the film industry is going to take away from this year, from its successes and failures?
You're going to see more and more so-called niche marketing. Thank God, you know, people no longer, I hope, it's also a matter of actors lowering their salaries. You know, people putting smaller amounts of money and, you know, not as dependent on the sort of blockbuster receipts. The other thing that Hollywood is obsessed with right now is, issues of sort of privacy in the new media. For advanced critic screenings in New York, they practically do a cavity search when you go in, you know, and sometimes you can't even concentrate on the movie because there are these huge guys in the front staring at you with these night vision goggles. You know, you're afraid to pick your nose. And
but they're making sure you don't have recording
they're
equipment
making sure you,
so that
you haven't
you
brought
can't
in
pirate
cameras.
The movie.
Oh, you have to turn in, you know, any cell phone that has a camera. You have to turn in your laptops. You know, they go through your pockets. I'm not joking. And they're just afraid that people are going to get these and they're going to put them on the internet. And, you know, more and more we're going to actually be watching movies on the internet. So I don't think the fear is unfounded, you know. And more we're going to find ourselves living in a very private culture. You know, movies delivered to homes via DVD, cable, the internet. One very well-known exhibitor is trying to close the three-month window between theatrical and video releases so that you can go to the theater or buy a movie simultaneously. I really, really hate that idea. But then I know I'm in a pretty rarefied position getting to see every movie that comes out, and not everybody is quite so lucky. But, you know, I think the loss of, you know, of public exhibition and of the thrill of, you know, sitting with other people and responding as one to a great movie, it's something I grew up with. It's something I want my kids and my kids' kids to grow up with. It's something that I think makes this such a thrilling medium and so different from television.
Well, David, I want to wish you happy holidays, and thanks for talking with us about the movies of the year.
Terry, it's always a joy.
David Edelstein is the film critic for Fresh Air and the online magazine Slate. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Diane Reeves from the soundtrack of Good Night and Good Luck.
I've got my eyes on you, so best beware.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Anne Bronte's neglected novel, Agnes Grey, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, in stores and online. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This year for Christmas, there's something I'd really like. So if you're up there somewhere, Santa, please don't bring me another bike.
We're listening to the new Christmas single by Fountains of Wayne. Coming up, Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker joins us to play and talk about the music on his 10 best list.
That I want most of all. I want an alien for Christmas. Bring me an alien this year. I want a little green guy about 3 feet high with 17 eyes who knows how to fly. I want an alien for Christmas this year. So don't worry about a thing. And I'll take him out for walks when it gets nicer in the spring. I'll always keep him company. He'll never be alone. And we can hang around the house all day and watch the twilight zone. I want an alien for Christmas. Bring me an alien this year. I want a little green guy about 3 feet high with 17 eyes who knows how to fly. I want an alien.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has been at work compiling his 10 best list, and he's here to present it and play some music from it. Let's start with the title song from the CD that tops his list, Fiona Apple's Extraordinary Machine.
I certainly haven't been shopping for any new shoes, and I certainly haven't been spreading myself around. I still only travel by foot, and by foot it's a slow climb, but I'm good at being uncomfortable. trouble, so I can't stop changing all the time. I notice that my opponent is always on the go and won't go slow, so's not to focus. And I notice he'll let you ride with any guide as long as they go fast from whence he came. But he's no good at being uncomfortable, so we can't stop staying exactly the same. If there was a better way to go, then it would find me. I can't help it, the road just rolls out behind me. Be kind to me, or treat me mean. I'll make the most of it, I'm an extraordinary machine. I seem to you.
That's the title track from Fiona Apple's latest CD, Extraordinary Machine, and it's the CD at the top of Ken Tucker's 10 Best List. Ken, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
Why does the CD get the top place on your list?
I just think the extraordinary craftsmanship of it. I think Fiona Apple really made a remarkable album, and the saga behind it was so interesting. She made this album years ago with producer John Bryan, and her record company said it's too arty, sounds too much like an art rock record from the 60s. Go back and try and put some different beats behind it. And she worked with a hip-hop producer named Mike Elizondo. And I think the album still works as a very much a contemporary pop album. I love the way, you know, she's very much in that kind of singer-songwriter confessional mode, but at the same time, she plays off of it. She appears and tries to sound vulnerable and waif-like when actually there's a tremendous amount of fury and wit. There are songs like Red, Red, Red and Get Him Back, which Get Him Back is like a pun. When I get him back, when I get him back into my arms, or I'm going to get him back, I'm going to have my revenge upon him. The album is just filled with that kind of wordplay. It's surrounded by all this ornate instrumentation and very modern beats. I just think it's a wonderful synthesis of things, and every song on the album I just loved.
Is this a good year for women in music?
It's a really good year. I mean, I had more fun this year listening to women making all kinds of music. I don't know why. It doesn't seem to be any kind of, you know.
No sociological analysis for
no,
us?
No. I tried to think, is it the war? People want to be comforted by hearing women? No, that wasn't it.
That might be sexist.
That's right. So, you know, it's just country music. Women, I thought, were very, very strong. People like Gretchen Wilson followed up her album Redneck Woman with another good album called All Jacked Up. A very popular Carrie Underwood, who won the American Idol, has the number one country album. But the best country music was made by women who also sort of look back on their past, and foremost among them, I thought, was Martina McBride, who made this album called Timeless, which was just a collection of her favorite old country songs. And the song I'd like to play is called Pick Me Up on Your Way Down, which is just a great old Harlan Howard song. It was a hit for Charlie Walker, who was a disc jockey in Texas in 1958. It's just a great old song, and she does a really good job on it.
Let's hear it. Martina McBride from her CD Timeless, which is on Ken Tucker's Top 10 of the Year. And we're reviewing the year in pop music with Ken Tucker, Fresh Air's rock critic. So, you know, country music, it of all the genres of music in America, it's country music that seems most like it's like a battleground for the culture wars with a lot of political divisions that get reflected in the songs, not in the song that we just heard, though.
Yes. In fact, one of the things on my list I wanted to do this year was to put a book on it. The best music book I read this year was by writer Chris Willman. It's called Rednecks and Bluenecks, The Politics of Country Music, and it takes as its jumping-off point the remark that Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks made in 2003, where she said from the stage, just so you know, we're ashamed of the President of the United States that he's from Texas, and she got booed on stage. And it set up this incredible, electrifying tension within Nashville and across country radio. Dixie Chicks songs were banned. And the polar opposite of that was Toby Keith, who became this very big champion of the war in Iraq and soldiers and had this big hit called Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue. What Chris Willman did was he went down to Nashville and spent a lot of time with artists and record executives. And it's really fascinating where he finds people are very much open about where they stand. You know, Brooks and Dunn, a very popular country duo, are very staunch Republicans, did fundraisers for George W. Bush. And they love just debating points about the war and talking about things. And Willman delves into this. And one of the interesting things I thought, a point he makes, is when you often hear people say, oh, that Alec Baldwin, I wish he'd keep quiet. I hate it when celebrities talk about the politics, things like that, and actors or rock stars. And Willman says, country music stars aren't often called celebrities because so much of their public persona, no matter who they are, no matter what side they're on, is about being part of the common man, that common touch. He makes the point that a teenage girl may dream of someday meeting Britney Spears but never really expects to. He said, but you'd be hard-pressed not to find a country music fan who has not met one or two of his or her favorite country artists, because part of the idea is you when a star gives a country music concert, you stick around, you give autographs. They have fanfare down in Nashville every year where anybody can go down and meet the very biggest stars in country music. So there's a kind of connection there. And so consequently, country music stars feel much more free, I think, to express themselves in interviews when they want to, on stage, in their music, certainly going, you know, way back to Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, made their political beliefs very widely known. Johnny Cash certainly did. And Willman's book is this, Willman, I should say, full disclosure, a once and future colleague of mine at Entertainment Weekly, does a terrific job of pulling together strands. It's in no way, and it's a very kind of balanced book in the sense that he talks to very conservative Nashville Row record executives, publishers, songwriters, and people who feel marginalized, like Rodney Crowell and Steve Earle, who feel like they really love country music and wish they could get played on country radio but just aren't.
I before we get back to your top 10, just a really quick question here. Thumbs up or thumbs down on the Johnny Cash movie, Walk the Line?
Oh, I thought, I love Reese Witherspoon. I think she's terrific as June Carter Cash, but there's something about the opening Folsom Prison concert scene. I think it's fantastic. I think that James Mangold, the writer-director, gives a very superficial kind of biopic treatment to what was an absolutely fascinating life, and there are many, many missed opportunities for me. I thought the acting was very good, though.
But not the singing from Joaquin Phoenix.
No, I just didn't think, I think he slipped in and out of it too much. I didn't really get that soulfulness that Johnny Cash had for me. Reese Witherspoon did it for me, but not Joaquin, I'm afraid.
My guest is Ken Tucker, Fresh Air's rock critic, and we're reviewing the year in music. You know, when we started, you talked about what a strong year this is for women, and we heard Fiona Apple and Martina McBride. Are there other examples of what a strong year this has been for women?
Yes, all across the map of pop music, everything from very big names like Mariah Carey made this very unexpected comeback, her album The Emancipation of Mimi, which got more Grammy nominations than any other album. Shakira, who had the first top five single sung in Spanish this year, and then onto smaller acts that I thought put out terrific records that I've reviewed over the course of the year here, like the Detroit Cobras, their album called Baby. Rachel Nagy has such a terrific voice. Dressy Bessie, a terrific pop rock band. I even liked Ashley Simpson, her single Didn't Steal Your Boyfriend. I think it's a terrific pop song. But among those other smaller acts, Fiery Furnaces, which is a brother and sister duo, Matt and Eleanor Friedberger, they made an extraordinary album, a kind of concept album called Rehearsing My Choir. And what they did was they asked their 83-year-old grandmother, Olga Sorantos, to come in and talk about her life growing up in Chicago and just set those reminiscences to music. And it's a beautiful kind of surreal, swirling music around her voice. The cut we're going to play is called The Garfield L, which is the elevated train in Chicago, and it's a reminiscence of that time. And the first voice you're going to hear is Olga Sorantos, and I mentioned that because her voice is kind of gruff and deep, and you might think it's a man at first, but it's this old woman. And it's followed by Eleanor Friedberger also singing alongside of her.
I found a skeleton tooth in the junk drawer, and I mean to open the folding green and white door and take a late train to my lost love. Faster hammers, chatter down the tracks through thumbtacks, slyly skull teeth, ticking $5 throwaway pianos past. A late train to my lost love.
Listen to those dead pianos
by Act
stuck
of Congress
in
the halls, and blue all the way to Forest Park.
Wood chipped and dildo steel, rattling and shattered and chewing
and
on
this ribbon spinning in computer.
That's the Fiery Furnaces from their album Rehearsing My Choir, one of the albums on our rock critic Ken Tucker's 10 Best list for the year. Ken, hearing that, I'm really reminded of, it sounds to me like a very pop reworking of Steve Reich's Different Trains.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. It is that kind of rhythm, that kind of pulsating rhythm to it. A lot of the tracks have that. It's a you know, very much an art record, but I think with this very original use of this woman's talking rather than conventional rock vocals.
Our rock critic Ken Tucker will play more music from his 10 Best list after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ken Tucker, Fresh Air's rock critic, and we're talking about the year in music, and soon he will read us his entire 10 Best list. As we've discussed on the show, Ken, you've been a rock critic, a film critic, a television critic. During your rock critic years for newspapers, mm-hmm. you had to go to concerts nearly every night.
Right.
Now that you're not writing as a rock critic for a newspaper and you're not obliged to go to concerts every night, have you been still going to concerts, and are there any concerts this year that you saw that were particularly interesting?
I saw a Bob Dylan show, and I went to this Bob Dylan show purely by accident. A friend had an extra ticket. I went thinking, oh, Bob Dylan, I've seen him 100 times. And it was one of the most extraordinary shows, literally, that I've ever seen. He's 63 years old. I mean, as we know, Bob Dylan's had a great year. I mean, he's put out this terrific book, Chronicles. He's just announced that he's going to do a satellite radio show. He's done a lot of things this year, but he's just maintained this steady touring schedule. And I saw him at the Beacon Theater in New York, and he came out and he had this, he's very, very thin, very gaunt, and the ticket stub says, The Bob Dylan Show. And that's what it is. It's like a show. He had Merle Haggard as his opening act, and Merle Haggard comes on, he's very jovial, and plays his, you know, his big hits. And that kind of sets up something for Dylan, because everything is implied with Dylan, and what Merle Haggard implies for Dylan is, you're not going to get that from me. He comes out, and he never looks at the audience. He just looks at the band. He goes over. He never picked up a guitar the whole time. He would go over to the keyboards and kind of stab at them really fast, and the blast back power of that band was as loud as any rock band I've ever heard. It was just absolutely thrilling. I could feel the hair on the back of my neck just rise up. He sang, I'll Be Your Baby Tonight, and he just bit off the words. He'd say, you know, shut the blinds, shut them tight. And it was as though he's about to direct a porn film, the way he said those words. It was just it was just so wonderful. And the frailness was deceptive, and he used it because he was like a marionette. His hands kind of moved around the way he stabbed at the keyboards. And I just thought, there's such energy and such drive. He was kind of bent over like Jim Carrey and Lemony Snicket, but there was like just this tremendous reworking constantly of familiar songs. He would puff on a harmonica and then go into Desolation Row and make it sound like Marty Robbins' El Paso, a mariachi ballad. It was just amazing. And at the end, they finished the band, and then Dylan finished Desolation Row. They put down their instruments. They come to the edge of the stage, and they stand in a line. And Dylan looks to his left at his colleagues, and he looks to his right, and then he looks out at the crowd, and he nods once. And to me, that said, we may as well have had Tommy guns in our hands. We blew you away, and we know it. And he just walked off. No encores.
Did it make you think about Dylan any differently than you did before?
It certainly made me admire his longevity, and when I thought about what I had seen in the Martin Scorsese DVD, No Direction Home, all those reminiscences, that sense that he has of himself as a self-created person, and that he thinks of himself as an entertainer and as much of as an artist, that he's a constantly working, he wants to be on the road, he wants to be out there and get that feedback, that kind of
And put on a show.
And put on a show, like a real old-fashioned, you know, he compares himself to like Al Jolson rather than other rock figures. Whenever he talks about his influences, they're not really rock and roll musicians. They're people from other eras. I just think he's the most amazing singer-songwriter, rock performer of our era.
Ken, how was this year in hip-hop?
Hip-hop, I felt, was in kind of a holding pattern in the sense that the same people who had big hits last year had big hits this year. Kanye West, his album Late Registration, he had this big hit, Gold Digger, which I thought was a really fun single with Jamie Foxx doing this kind of Ray Charles impersonation. 50 Cent put out this that movie Get Rich or Die Trying, which was pretty bad, didn't do very well. 50 Cent, increasingly to me, is kind of like the Mike Tyson of hip hop. He's just sort of big and there and lumbering and not particularly interesting, powerful but not effective. So to me, the work that's being done is still the more interesting stuff that's being done on the fringes. Like this guy who calls himself Lyrics Born. I reviewed his album earlier this year. There's a four-letter word in the title of the album. So the name of the album is called Same Blank Different Day. The cut I'd like to play from Lyrics Born is called I'm Just Raw.
His name is Lyrics Born, and he is, as they say, wild and crazy. As a composer, arranger, and producer, he's exploring it all, from the furthest reaches of musical outer space to the most down-to-earth funk. And he sounds, well, he sounds exactly like this.
Nobody remembers those Rap City episodes from 20 years ago when you were the guest host. Past history, let it go. Get off on a medical. Pack a duffel bag with all your wrinkled clothes and pedal home. Get a little dictaphone and shit alone in the middle of the room and let it flow. Wouldn't it be better if you went and chose a new career path like a shepherd or a flight attendant on an aircraft? You're pitiful, a polywog, tiny fishy in a smaller pond, holding Barbie dolls and leftover beads from the Mardi Gras. Acting hella hard, but that's just poppycock, cause inside you're hella soft like a Jolly Rancher lollipop. I'll give you cauliflower ears, stupid. You're weird, feeling blue on a stool somewhere, two fisting beers at a half brown, moaning like a hot cow, riding on the shoulder of some old man you met just now. I'm smarter than you, I'm harder than you, I'm better than you, I'm just wrong. I'm hotter than you, more popular than you, more clever than you, and gosh darn it, people like me. I'm smarter than you, I'm harder than you.
That's Lyrics Born. Our rock critic Ken Tucker will play more music from his 10 best list after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker. He's reviewing the year in rock music. Ken, what did the year look like in indie rock?
Well, indie rock was the kind of year where it was most clear how differently people consume music. People heard about bands in many different ways. Indie bands don't get played on big commercial rock stations. And it's like my daughter, she did not buy an album all year. She would download music from the internet. We would go on websites like pitchfork.com, which covers a lot of indie bands, to learn about what was, you know, out there and available. People watch videos on MTV2, which actually plays music videos. And get exposed to bands on television shows like The OC. And there's a show called Veronica Mars on UPN about a young teenage girl who moonlights as a detective. And this band that I'm about to play, Spoon, they just announced that they're going to play. It no longer is it a sign of selling out to appear on a TV show. In fact, it's another way to get your music heard. So I thought among indie bands, the Death Cab for Cutie and Wolf Parade, a band from Canada, had particularly strong albums. But this Spoon album called Gimme Fiction, their fifth album, a band from Austin, Texas, I thought was just really, really terrific. The song I want to play is The Beast and Dragon Adored.
That's Spoon from their CD, Gimme Fiction, one of the CDs on Ken Tucker's 10 Best list of the year. Ken, before we heard that, you were talking about how young people now are listening to music differently. They're not getting it from the radio so much. They're listening on iPods and downloading and listening to singles more than CDs often. Do you find that your way of finding out about new recordings or the ways in which you listen to new recordings have changed?
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot more reading, a lot more surfing the internet, going, as I said before, going to websites. It's almost as if music is kind of in the air, but it's not on the radio. I mean, I listen to a lot of different kinds of radio stations. And I find pop radio stations annoying because they don't tell you the name of the band half the time. So, you know, it's that kind of thing. And so I just listen to what friends recommend to me, what my daughters recommend to me. And I've enjoyed more music this year than I have in recent years. So I think that kind of letting the music wash over you and discovering things, I think if you take that plunge, you set yourself up for a really enjoyable experience.
Well, this is that stirring time of the year when when you present your full 10 best list.
Yes.
So let's begin the dramatic reading.
Yes. Well, as I said last year, I was no longer going to do a list of just albums because of all the things we've been talking about, because they're just you get music in so many different ways. So this is a mixture of things. Number one is the album by Fiona Apple, Extraordinary Machine. Number two is that cut from Spoon, The Beast and Dragon Adored. Number three is Martina McBride, the song I played, Pick Me Up On Your Way Down, I thought was just wonderful. Number four is Fiery Furnaces, the entire album called Rehearsing My Choir. Number five is Kanye West's song, Gold Digger, just loved it. Number six is Chris Willman's book, Rednecks and Bluenecks, Politics and Country Music. Number seven is the Detroit Cobras album, Baby, the whole album, it's just terrific. Number eight is Lyrics Born, same blank, different day. Number nine is Bob Dylan's DVD, No Direction Home. And number 10, as far as I was concerned, the reissue of the year, this four-disc set on Rhino called One Kiss Can Lead to Another, Girl Group Sounds Lost and Found.
And should we close with a track from the girl group's reissue?
That'd be great, yes, by a woman named Dawn. Beyond that, she is unknown to pop history, as far as I can tell, and the song is called I'm afraid they're all talking about me.
So this box set has girl groups who are well-known and others who are very obscure.
Most very obscure indeed, yeah. And it's a wonderful excavation of pop past. You listen to it and you think, why wasn't that a number one hit single like this song?
Well, Ken, thanks for reviewing the year in music.
Thank you.
And happy holidays.
You too.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic and film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I never had much confidence in myself. Was it the way that I was brought up that made me dependent on someone else?
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From Universal Pictures, presenting Munich, directed by Steven Spielberg and starring Eric Bana, Daniel Craig, and Jeffrey Rush, in select cities December 23rd. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times Baghdad correspondent Dexter Filkins about the election in Iraq. He won the George Polk Award for War Reporting earlier this year. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.